Jeopardy!
Too many matches with no storylines and a predictable and boring ending.
What is WWE?
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the street.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
I'm fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 412 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, December 6, 2015. I am the Solid Monster, back from the dead, and feeling much better than I was when I did the show last week. I can tell you that much, especially because it turned out I had the flu. Which I didn't realize at the time that I did the podcast, but I found out the next morning when I woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning with my head pounding and 102 fever, and I had no choice but to go to the doctor. Of course, it had to be the final day of my health insurance through work, which the doctor's office would not accept, so that was even more fun, having to pay out of pocket for that. But no, I had no idea that I had the flu, because I had never had it before. This is the first time I actually have ever had it, and it is no fun. It is no fun. Knocked me for a loop. I didn't even go back to work until Friday. I guess the one good thing is I lost a few pounds, so that's good, I guess. But yeah, don't get sick with the flu. The other thing I was able to do, my brother actually bought me the entire box set. This was 2 years ago for my birthday. He bought me the entire box set of the old TV show. It was on ABC many years ago called The Commish. Anybody who knows Michael Chiklis, he was on The Shield, which is probably my all-time favorite show, right up there with Breaking Bad. But before he did The Shield, he was a cop on a completely different kind of show. He was a police commissioner in some fictional little town in New York somewhere. And I used to watch that show when I was a kid, and I hadn't seen it in many years, and he bought me the entire box set, all five seasons. And it's been sitting here, wrapped in plastic for 2 years. And so finally I said, you know, I'm laying here. I have a little crappy old, you know, SD television in my room. I can't even watch the network on my TV. So I'm not gonna do that. I said, let's crack open The Commish. So that's how I spend most of my week, watching episodes of The Commish. And I got to tell you, it's a great show. It's a great show. But then again, if you've listened to this podcast before, you know I am a mark for I am a mark for Michael Chiklis. I am a big fan of his work. So anyway, that's how I spend my week. I'm sure your week was far more fun than mine. Want to mention here, didn't realize it until this past week, but the voting is now open again. It is actually the nominating process. We're not quite in the voting stage yet, per se, but you can nominate this podcast for the 2016 Wrestling Radio Awards. We won the award for Show of the Year and Host of the Year for 2015, which is pretty cool. So I want to repeat. So you can go on WrestlingRadioAwards.com right now. The nominating, nominating period is open. There's different boxes. You have to manually write in the names of different shows. But under the box for Show of the Year, just write in Solid Monster Sounds Off and click Submit. I don't know when they're going to cut off the nominating period and name the finalists, but if you haven't already done that, you can vote once a day, every day. Don't vote more than that because they'll disqualify all your votes. You can vote once a day, every day going forward until I say otherwise, I guess. So go to WrestlingRadioAwards.com, type in Solid Monster Sounds Off under Show of the Year, and help this show get nominated once again for Show of the Year. Also, Audible, still offering their 30-day trial period to listeners of the Sound Off. You can use our URL, audibletrial.com/Solid Monster. I was fiddling around on Audible just to see if there are any new books that are out, any new audiobooks that I'm not aware of. There was one thing I noticed. It's not a book, but it is a short 10-minute interview that was conducted in June of 2001 with the Macho Man, Randy Savage. It was on a radio show. For whatever reason, they have the interview up on Audible, and you can, in fact, use your one free cash-in on this interview. So if you want to listen to a quick 10-minute interview that you've probably never heard before with the Macho Man in his own voice, from many years ago. He talks about his career, working in Memphis, working in WWE, working in WCW. You can sign up for Audible right now using our link. Go through the full sign-up process. You got 30 days to sample the service, and you can cash in your free book on this audio interview with the Macho Man. It's called Wrestling Icons, Randy Savage Interview. That's all you got to type in. Again, it's from June of 2001. Sounds pretty cool. So if you're a Macho Man fan, you might want to check that out. Use our URL, audibletrial.com/Solomonster. And finally here, if you would like to make a PayPal donation, if you like what you hear every week, and I hope you do, go on the Solomonster.com. The Solomonster.com right-hand side, you'll see the PayPal box. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname. I want to say thank you this week to Gilbert Lopez, Christopher Hicks, Yvonne Bruiser Balick, John Loose Cannon Lopez, Bobby the Wizard Waldrop, Eugene Crazy Eyes Morgan, Killshot Keith Hart, Deadpool James Herrera, The Bronx Bomber Robert Hordeens, Juggernaut Jesse Rusolaxo, Master Blaster Samarth Gupta, Luck is for Losers Lance Flint, Ryan the Saint Santelli, Hytham the Equalizer Al Nawasser, Jam Master Jamie Wood, Canadian Destroyer Rob Morrow, Dream Chaser Chauncey Curry, and the Chief of Grief, Scott Ferguson. Thank you very much for everybody who made a donation this week. Again, you can do so on thesolomonster.com. Two more quick plugs that have nothing to do with me. I want to give a shout-out here to my boy, Brad Gilmore, and his podcast, Your Opinion Doesn't Matter. And as I told him, the first time he told me the name of his show, I thought it was the name of WWE's official podcast. I thought they had created one. Apparently not. Your Opinion Doesn't Matter. Brad Gilmore and Matt Topolsky are the hosts. They are also the announcers for Booker T's Reality of Wrestling promotion down in Houston. Two good guys. They don't just talk about wrestling on the podcast. They talk about sports. They talk pop culture. Pretty much everything. So if you want to check them out, I would suggest you do so. Go to opinionpodcast.com. They do the show 5 days a week. You can also listen on iTunes. And lastly, I wanted to bring attention to something very cool that one of our listeners is doing to help the homeless here in New York City. Matt Harrigan is his name. He has started a GoFundMe for his Super Kick the Holidays campaign, which is about raising money to buy long sleeve shirts, hats, hoodies for the Young Bucks and the Bullet Club. All, you know, a lot of their merchandise, and of course the Bucks are members of the Bullet Club. You could tell that Matt is a big Young Bucks fan. He wants to buy their gear to give out to homeless and needy people in New York this winter. And if you've never been through a New York winter before, it gets pretty frickin' cold up in these parts. One of the things I absolutely hate about living in New York City. He is about halfway. He might have actually just passed the halfway point to his goal. And he's working with churches and shelters to get the stuff to the people who need it the most. So if you want to help out, it is GoFundMe.com/SuperKickTheHolidays, or you can follow at SuperKickXmas on Twitter. It's a very cool thing that Matt is doing, so I wanted to give it some attention here. I mentioned Brad Maddox on the show last week. I just want to follow up on that. Of course, Brad Maddox, for those of you who don't know by now, he was fired by WWE after he used the phrase cocky pricks in a promo before a dark match at the SmackDown tapings against R-Truth last week. As soon as he walked through the curtain, he knew right away Vince McMahon was not happy about what had happened, and they fired him. And he admitted as much in an interview that he did this week with Rolling Stone magazine. He said he called the crowd in Indianapolis pricks, and that's what got him fired. He is now taking indie dates under the name Mad Braddox, which I think is fucking hilarious. He's got some funny shirts as well in his pro wrestling tee store. There's the cocky prick shirt, of course. Don't be a prick, with a picture of a cactus on it. The Indianapolis Pricks, which is a takeoff of the Indianapolis Colts logo. Arrive, do nothing, get paid. Best job ever. And finally, you can get the Arrive, work dark match, get fired shirt. WWE doesn't seem to think this is all so funny. They may be taking legal action against Maddox to get him to change his name and shut down his store, arguing that Mad Braddox is too similar to his old name, which they own the rights to, and they say it may cause confusion. That's what they say. I say, keep doing what you're doing. Let them threaten all they want to. Guy's got to make a living. So anyway, that's the update on Mad Braddox. I love that name. WWE sent out another one of their fan council surveys this past week, a couple of days after my rant last week about how they don't give a shit what you think, which I stand by. Basically, the purpose of this survey was to ask the fans, why are you not watching our show anymore? They want to know why people are tuning out of Raw. It was a bogus survey, though, because they didn't include an option to upload a JPEG image of Vince McMahon. They could have saved everybody a lot of time by just doing that, no writing necessary. It was mostly questions about viewing habits and that sort of thing. So, with some help from Noah Mark, who I have to thank, we decided to replicate 10 of the questions from the survey. Now, I constantly get messages from people asking me, how can I take these surveys? How do you get on the fan council? Don't ask me. I don't know. I signed up for it one day a long, long time ago. And when there's a survey, sometimes I don't get them. Most of the time I do. They send me an email with a link. I click the link. I take the survey. That's it. From what I understand, people have tried to sign up for the fan council, and it's closed. They have too many members. Just keep checking back. That's all. Just go on the WWE site and just keep checking back. And every now and then, I'm sure they'll open up a spot. But there's nothing I can do. I don't know what their process is in selecting people. Some people thought maybe it was a network thing. You have to be a network subscriber to get links to these surveys. It has nothing to do with the network. It's this fan council thing that they set up through a third party that handles all of this for them. And I take the surveys when they send them to me. So I just wanted to mention that. But because a lot of people were not able to get the survey and were not able to take it, we decided to replicate 10 of the questions. These are not all of them, but the 10 that SurveyMonkey allowed us to replicate, although I did have to shell out money after the fact when I realized I was only allowed to view 100 responses unless I paid them. And we got a hell of a lot more than 100 responses. I think we hit 100 in less than 10 minutes after I put the survey up. So I looked at that and I said, well, that's not good. But we ended up with well over 1,000 responses, the results of which I'm going to get into right now. You won't hear the results from WWE, they keep that internal, but I'm going to go through our results here and now. This is real fan feedback that you're going to hear right here on the podcast. Who knows what WWE will do with the feedback that they actually received, but one thing is for sure, it will not make a damn bit of difference when it comes to the creative direction of their product. That I can tell you. They don't care. The last 6 months of surveys that I've taken have proven that they don't care. Nothing has changed. Nothing. Not a thing. And some people may ask, well then, why do I keep answering these surveys? If nothing ever changes, if they don't matter, why do I take them? The simple, honest answer, I love filling out surveys. They send me one, I fill it out. It's a weakness of mine. It's like popping bubble wrap. You know, I can't help myself. That's the honest answer. But let's go through the questions here. The first one that we asked in our version of the survey, how often do you typically watch Monday Night Raw? And not surprisingly, the vast majority, 51% of you, watch every single week. Why, I have no idea. But 51% watch every single week. I mean, it wasn't even close. The next response down is 19%, and those are the people that watch one or two times per month. So, by and large, most of you guys are watching the show. The ones that are still watching, you're watching every week. Second question, how have your viewing habits of Raw changed compared to the past? And the vast, vast majority of respondents say they are watching Raw less. So, now that doesn't necessarily mean they're not watching at all. Some people might skip weeks here and there, but if you want to reconcile, well, if people are watching by and large every week, then how could they be watching less? Well, what I take that to mean is they ain't sticking around for the full 3 hours. And actually, the Raw ratings seem to bear that out. A lot of times they'll start strong. The second hour maybe will go up. The second hour may go down a little bit. But then that third hour just sinks like a stone. And, you know, these results here seem to bear out that same thing. The people who are watching Raw are watching less and less of the show. 73% said they're watching less. 25% say they're watching Raw the same amount. And under 2% say they're watching more of Raw. Question 3. Which of the following ways do you watch Raw? And the options here, WWE Network, of course, they get the Raw episodes about a month after they air on television. There's a little bit of a delay. WWE app, some people watch it live when it airs. Do you watch highlights on WWE.com or on YouTube? DVR is another option. Hulu is another option. The top response here, most people watch the show live when it airs, 51%. The next option down, 29, almost 30%, was DVR. 26% were highlights on WWE.com or social media, and the other answers were far below that. So the vast majority are still watching the show live on Monday nights when it airs. Question 4, which of the following describes how many hours of Raw you tend to watch during any given week? This was a lot more even. 28% of you say that you watch less than an hour of Raw during any given week. 24% say at least an hour. 23% at least 2 hours. And 23% also say an entire episode. So this was very, very much even here. There was no one dominant answer. Question 5. Do you ever change the channel during Raw, including during commercial breaks? 54% say always. 32% say sometimes. Only 13% say never. Question 6. What are some reasons why you fast-forward during recorded episodes of Raw? 67%. Now, the numbers here are going to sound a little weird. It's because people could pick multiple answers. So again, what are some reasons why you fast-forward during the show? 67% say the match is not exciting. They're just not interested in the match that's on TV at any given moment. 64% say they're not interested in a particular superstar or diva. 63% commercial breaks. Can't stand them. 45% say talking segments. 22% backstage interviews. And only 7% say I never fast forward through episodes of Raw. The the vast majority, or I should say the vast minority of people, say they never fast forward. Question 7. In general, do you watch Monday Night Football? 67% say no. 32% say yes. Now, this doesn't surprise me. Because I'm sure we had a lot of UK people and international people filling out this survey. They don't give a shit about Monday Night Football. They may not even know what it is. So I think that probably factored into it as well. But yeah, the majority do not watch Monday Night Football. And so for them, it's not an excuse as far as why Raw's ratings are down. Question number 8. Thinking about Raw over the last few months following SummerSlam. That's the question they asked that we're replicating here. And that's interesting because that's really when the numbers started to drop. It was actually the end of August, beginning of September, just before football season began. That's when the numbers really began to take a tumble. And also the quality of the shows took a gigantic tumble. So what they want to know is, thinking about Raw since SummerSlam, how would you rate Raw on the following metrics and segments? 1 being dislike a lot, 5 being like a lot. Okay? Now I'm looking at this here. I'm looking at this in color chart form. And not surprisingly, the answer that got the greatest response, that they like a lot, is the athleticism of the wrestlers. I don't know anybody who doubts the athleticism of the men and women on that show every week. They go out there, they do these incredible feats, they're tremendous athletes. Nobody is denying that. Nobody, I don't think, has ever taken away from that. So that answer is not surprising. But I'm looking at some other things here. I'm looking at backstage interviews, for example. Backstage interviews, people more or less were around a 3 on that, so that's like right in the middle. But I'm looking at some of the ones that stand out to me that only got a 1 or a 2. And level of entertainment, very low on the list. People not very entertained by what they're seeing on Raw. Storylines, even lower than that. Between a 1 and a 2. Is what people gave storylines on average. Entertaining from start to finish. Same thing, between a 1 and a 2. That's where this averaged out. Backstage interactions, also pretty low on the list. Just shy of a 3 is what people gave it. But the things that people really rated Raw for the poorest, based on your response here, was level of entertainment, storylines, entertaining from start to finish, and providing unexpected moments. People are not getting what they want when it comes to those things. The things that were rated highest here, quality of the matches, athleticism of the talent. Again, this is not shocking stuff here. This is just kind of reaffirming what I think a lot of us already knew, is that most of the time when you give these guys time to go out there and have a great match, they have a damn good match, and they're great athletes. But it's a lot of the verbiage, it's a lot of the storylines, and it's just not fun. The show is largely a bore. So that's what I got out of question 8 here. Question 9. Typically, do you think each of the following segments of Raw are given too much, not enough, or just the right amount of time? This was an interesting question. So they have a lot of different options listed here. For example, superstars and divas in-ring promos to build storylines. This was kind of a split. Surprising in some ways to me. 41% of people said they get too much time. And 46% said they're not given enough time. So the majority think that there isn't enough time dedicated to actual in-ring promos that build storylines. Now, I am of the opinion that they don't always have to be in the ring. In fact, some might be better off not being in front of the crowd. That's just my opinion. But 46% say that they don't get enough time. And only 12% say given just the right amount of time. Talking segments about what is coming up in the show. People hate these. 78% say they get way too much time. Only 11% said they don't get enough time. And 10% said they get just the right amount. So people do not like the amount of time that they dedicate on Raw to talking about what's coming up in the show. Talking segments from commentators about what has already happened. 79% say too much time is given to that. Only 9% say not enough time. So that's something else people clearly hate when we have Michael Cole talking about what the fuck we just saw. Too much time dedicated to that. Backstage interviews, 22% say too much time is given to them. 30% say not enough time, and 47% think just the right amount of time. So people are satisfied with the amount of time that the backstage interviews get. Backstage interactions, 41% say not enough time is given to the backstage stuff. Only 21% say too much time is given to it. Divas and Superstars matches, 69% said that not enough time is given to the matches themselves. Which, of course, is not always the case. We had a 25-minute main event on Raw this week that actually wasn't that good at all. But I think the key word in there may be divas. That might be coloring this a little bit, because the divas clearly do not get enough time on most weeks. 69% say not enough time. Matches that do not affect storylines. 66% of you say those matches are given too much time. If they don't affect storylines, you don't want to see them. They're a waste of time. Main event matches, 46% think just the right amount of time is given. 40% say not enough time is given to the main events. Only 12% say too much time is given to the main events. Matches that do affect storylines, 72% of you say not enough time is given to matches that actually mean something. I can't say that I disagree with that. Championship matches, 62% of you say not enough time is given to championship matches, or that there aren't enough championship matches. People want to see title matches. That's what they want to see. And last but not least on this question, recaps of previous episodes, 79% of you say way too much time is dedicated to recapping previous episodes of Raw. Last question, number 10, how would the inclusion of the following ideas impact your interest in viewing Raw more often? So here's the takeaway from this last question here. Specialty matches, which are, you know, gimmick matches, basically. That was one of the options. 25% of you say you're somewhat interested in that. And 15% of you say that you're more interested in that. This was more of an even question. You know, pretty split. It's not dominant one way or the other. I'm just looking at some of the more interesting options here. Championship matches. This goes to what we were just talking about. Almost 31% are somewhat more interested in championship matches. 36% are more interested. Clearly, you guys want to see more title matches on this show. That is the takeaway. Celebrity guest appearances. 73% of you say you are less interested. So by far, you do not want to see celebrity guest appearances on Monday Night Raw. You have celebrity fatigue. Same thing for celebrities included in matches. 77% say no. And just scrolling down here to the last couple of options, legends appearances, people are somewhat evenly split. Almost 18% say you would be less interested in legends appearances. 27% would be somewhat interested. 26% don't have an opinion one way or the other. 20% of you would be somewhat more interested. So a somewhat surprising split, but maybe not too surprising. I think there's just a fatigue about bringing back old names for the sake of bringing back old names. I think they've done it so many times, people are kind of tired of it now. Same thing here. Legends included in matches was one of the options that they listed. 35% of you say you would be less interested in that. You don't want to see legends included in matches. You are perfectly content with the current roster as long as they're used the correct way. So, to recap, what people want are fewer talking segments about what's coming up in the show, fewer segments with the announcers talking about what we just saw, fewer matches that have no bearing on any ongoing storylines, more time for the Divas matches, more championship matches, and way less time devoted to recaps of previous episodes. So we're not really breaking a ton of new ground here. I think most of us would agree on all of these things. But one thing the WWE survey, not surprisingly, did not get into. For all the talk in the survey about what are all the reasons you're not watching this TV show, one thing it did not get into, there were no questions about specific superstars, who you would like to see more of, who you would like to see less of, and what you've thought of their storylines on television in the months since SummerSlam, right? Because that, I think, is one of the key weaknesses about this show. These stories are just not compelling at all. And the people that we want to see, we're either not seeing enough of them, or we're not happy with how they're being treated and booked on television. Didn't get into any of that stuff. And those questions strike me as being equally, if not more important, than a lot of the questions they asked here. Which just goes to my original point, I don't think they care. Now, speaking of polls, Raw last week, Instapoll up on Twitter, we had over 1,400 votes. Only 19% of you gave the show a thumbs up, 33% said thumbs down, 48% did not watch the show at all. And for those of you that have asked me, I'm not adding a thumbs in the middle option, so you can stop asking. If I added a thumbs in the middle option, everybody would choose thumbs in the middle. You know, because everybody can find one or two things to like on a 3-hour show, and then all of a sudden it becomes thumbs in the middle. One or two things does not make a good show. You need to decide if you think that overall, those 3 hours were worthy of a thumbs up or a thumbs down. You know, it's like you're either pregnant or you're not pregnant. There is no such thing as half pregnant. So I'm not giving people a cop-out option here. Ratings, by the way, were up 210,000 viewers overall, which is still record low levels. And that last hour dropped by 300,000 people with that big main event that they put together. So, hardly something to celebrate, but hey, I see Kay Jewelers is their newest sponsor. In fact, the TLC pay-per-view is being presented by both Kay Jewelers and Toys R Us, two sponsors that I don't think could possibly be any different from one another, any more different than they are. So, here's my prediction. I predict that Match or eHarmony will be WWE's next sponsor, with the idea that they want to help match you with someone so that you'll buy the engagement ring from Kay Jewelers. See? Sneaky, sneaky, sneaky. I missed a good part of the show because I was passed out in a flu-induced coma, but I did go back. I did watch most of it. We got a little taste of my Roman Empire idea I saw on this show. I saw Roman Reigns on my TV screen at one point holding the WWE title flanked by an Uso on each side. And I thought to myself, oh, what might have been? What might have been? But Now apparently they may be putting Roman together with Dean Ambrose and the Usos as a group called The Family, which is a name that's already been used before. I know at the time it was La Familia, but it's the same fucking thing. Actually, they have another stable with Family in their name right now, the Wyatt Family. So we'll see. That's just a rumor right now, the whole Family thing. It's not confirmed or anything. If you are wondering why Roman Reigns had the WWE title, if you are one of the many people no longer watching Raw who are wondering why would he have the championship, it's because he stole it from Sheamus in the opening segment of the show. You know, when a heel steals a belt from somebody, they're a heel. So it's okay. Stupid, but okay. When your top babyface steals a belt from somebody, unless they're throwing it over a bridge into a river, it's pretty stupid. Especially when in the very next segment, they simply hand the belt back over to their boss. But he was rewarded with a WWE Championship match against Sheamus on this show, so I guess it worked. The catch, though, was that it was one of my least favorite matches. It was a beat-the-clock challenge. And Roman would have to beat Sheamus in 5 minutes 15 seconds or less, which was the length of his title reign at Survivor Series. So that was the stipulation. We had Dolph Ziggler and Tyler Breeze. Again, no entrance for Breeze, which is a gigantic part of what got his character over on NXT in the first place. We can't have that on this show. They had a good match. Super kick by Ziggler for the win. Tyler Breeze sold that kick like death. We got a Miz TV segment with Lana and Rusev. Rusev said the one person who was there for him while he was out injured. He was out for all of 3 weeks, mind you. The one person was Lana. Lana was back. She was looking like old school Lana. It's like the last 6 months never happened. I'd like to forget the last 6 months ever happened, too. She said she was never, she never went all the way with Dolph Ziggler. Which is funny, because neither has WWE Creative. Rusev said he also never went all the way with Summer Rae. Go all the way. That's what they kept saying. I feel like I'm watching an after school special here. Go all the way. The two of them started making out in the ring, which was Vince McMahon's cue to send out the Ryback to make an unscripted crack that he heard. He heard from the Zigman that Lana, in fact, did go all the way with Dolph. I should say supposedly unscripted. Not even so much unscripted, I guess. It was just a case of Lana not knowing that the line was coming. She's not the most well-liked person behind the scenes right now, between her tweeting that photo of her engagement ring and screwing up their storyline plans, and her little social media smackdown with Paige a few weeks ago, which was not an angle. Ryback also said that this wasn't an episode of Teen Wolf, and he wanted to be fed more. Hey, you know, maybe we can get Teen Wolf to guest host Raw so he can devour that third hour. We won't have to suffer through that anymore. So this led to Ryback against Rusev, ended in less than 2 minutes, by countout, when Rusev was knocked into the ring steps. The ring steps then knocked into Lana's hip and caused her to fall down. And so instead of getting back inside to beat the count, Rusev, ever the gentleman that he is, he stayed behind to check on Lana and he took the loss. Now, especially given what we saw later in the show with Rusev and no Lana, this was a gigantic waste of time. This was one of those matches in the survey we just talked about that you people do not want to see. You do not want to see matches that have absolutely no bearing on any storylines at all. So that's what they gave us here. Backstage, Triple H told Dean Ambrose that if Roman Reigns could not beat Sheamus in under 5:15, he would not be getting his Intercontinental title match with Kevin Owens at TLC. The Dudley Boys came out for a promo on the Wyatt family. This was the first time that the Dudley, and specifically Bubba, had the chance to come out in the ring and really cut a promo. And if you remember how good of a promo that Bubba was when he was Bully Ray in TNA, we ought to use that little Men in Black memory thing I was talking about last week, because you're not supposed to remember that. This was Bubba Ray Dudley wearing the stupid glasses with the tape in the middle. This was just a promo. There was nothing special about it. They had a table in the ring for each member of the Wyatt family with their names on them. Bubba challenged them to come out, which was a challenge they accepted. The Dudley said, "You've got your family, and we've got ours." And all I could think is, oh God, they're going to bring out little Spike Dudley to get killed by Braun Strowman. Instead, they brought out Tommy Dreamer. Yes, he is back again. He was supposed to be helping TNA on their India tour, but LOL TNA, you need to have a tour in the first place in order for one to help you on said tour. Dreamer got a massive reaction with them being in Pittsburgh, not a huge surprise. And it's not just a one-off either. Dreamer is advertised for live events through the middle of January, so he's going to be sticking around. You know, somebody on our Facebook page asked if I think Tommy Dreamer will get into the WWE Hall of Fame. It's not much of a question about it to me. The answer is yes. I mean, look at the way they treat this guy. How many people do you think could be working for TNA one week and then back in WWE the next? This is not the first time that Tommy Dreamer has gone, you know, back to TNA to help them out, and then they bring Tommy Dreamer back to WWE, you know, and they allow him no less to wear a House of Hardcore shirt to plug his own promotion. How many people do you think they would allow to do that? They obviously think the world of him. You know, he's well respected. He's one of the founding fathers of that whole ECW crew. You know, Taz is going to get into the Hall of Fame eventually. RVD is going to get in for sure. The Dudleys are for sure going to get in. And Tommy Dreamer will too. And I think the perfect time for it will be when WrestleMania comes back to Philadelphia, which from the sounds of it could happen as early as 2018. I think you may see a bunch of ECW guys going into the Hall of Fame that year. So the Dudleys and Dreamer went to a double DQ with Harper and Rowan and Strowman. They laid out the Dudleys. Bray Wyatt told them to get the tables. And as they were getting the tables, Bubba popped up. He ran over to the apron where Bray was standing. He shoved Bray off the apron, and he fell backwards through a table on the floor. I didn't even see the table set up. So I actually thought that was a cool little surprise. And the babyface is scampered off. So they got the last laugh here on this show. They were advertising a singles match between Bray and Bubba for SmackDown, and I think it ended up being D-Von and Bray because, you know, the old man is just changing his mind constantly. Backstage, Becky Lynch suggested to Charlotte that they have a non-title match. Charlotte was not hot on the idea. She said she'd only do it if she could have her father at ringside. And all of a sudden, Ric Flair showed up. Talk about random. And he and Charlotte proceeded to woo at one another. This was a terrible segment, but it did play into something that would happen later on. The Lucha Dragons and the Usos went to a double DQ. They had a good match, as you would expect the two of them to have. Now, mind you, they went to a double DQ coming off a double DQ in the previous match and a two-minute countout before that. New Day was on commentary for this match. They ran in to attack both teams for the finish. The idea is, oh, neither one of you guys won, so therefore we don't have to defend our titles against you at the pay-per-view. But they would be wrong. WWE has since announced that it will, in fact, be the New Day defending against the Usos and the Lucha Dragons at TLC in a ladder match. Sasha Banks beat Brie Bella with the bank statement after a distraction by Naomi. And I'll tell you something, you know, if you're looking for an example of how damaging WWE booking can be, look no further than Sasha Banks. In some ways, they've protected her to this point. I still don't think she's lost a match, cleanly at least, on the show since she debuted. I know people are still into her, but I look at Sasha Banks. You know, she was one of the hottest acts in all of wrestling a couple of months ago. And that was on their quote-unquote developmental show. She was super popular. Now, I can barely bring myself to care when she comes to the ring. You know, and it's not because I don't enjoy seeing her. It's because I know that when she comes out, it's not for any particularly important reason. Just a quick 3-minute match. She doesn't look all that dominant or anything. And she just wins off a distraction like every other heel on the roster. Because here, on this show, that's all she is. She is every other heel on the roster. Whatever it was that made her special and made her stand out in NXT, which is a smaller show. Yes, it is a smaller roster. I get that. But whatever it was that made her special, it doesn't come through on this show. Nobody feels special. Brock Lesnar is the only one who feels special on this show. And that's only because he's never on the fucking show. So this is one of the many reasons I think that this show is suffering. And when people come up from NXT, I mean, yeah, every now and then somebody will slip in, they'll do very well for themselves. But the batting average, not very good when it comes to the NXT call-ups. Roman Reigns and Sheamus in a beat-the-clock challenge for the WWE Championship. They did this match at the top of the 10 p.m. hour, so you knew they weren't changing the title. That was a dead giveaway. Sheamus walked out wearing a Sheamus 515 shirt, which reminded me of Owen Hart's Owen 316, I just broke your neck shirt. Or when Shane McMahon wore his McMahon 632 shirt when he was twice the man that Austin was. The difference is that was funny, this was not. This was just lame. Reigns tried to go for pins early in the match, Sheamus kept kicking out. It was coming down to the wire, Roman Reigns had him set up for the spear when Rusev interfered for the DQ. Del Rio and Barrett showed up, they pulled Sheamus out of the ring. Sheamus then introduced us to his new stable, the League of Nations. So there's the international faction I talked about last week. I don't hate it. I don't hate the idea. I just don't buy them as any sort of real threat. The fact that Roman Reigns single-handedly beat them all on SmackDown in a handicap match just reinforces my point. But it's important to remember here, the only real purpose of the League of Nations here on this show is to get Roman Reigns over. That's it. Once they achieve that goal, they will be dissolved. Okay, this is not a long-term group. I would be shocked if this League of Nations lasts more than a month. They exist solely to make Roman look strong. And if that's the goal, I guess we'll see if it works. You know, Roman's not getting bad reactions right now. He's getting pretty good reactions. We'll see. We'll see if it works. But everything being done now is done with the sole purpose in mind of getting Roman Reigns over as the guy. It's not about Dean Ambrose. It's not about the Usos. They're all just background players. Doesn't matter how much you cheer for Dean Ambrose. It doesn't matter. You're cheering for nothing. He will never be the guy. Because Roman is their guy. It's about Roman Reigns. It's about one promoter's very myopic, that's probably a good word for it, myopic view on how things should still be done in 2016. You know, they've got a tables, ladders, and chairs match coming up at the pay-per-view with Roman Reigns and Sheamus, okay? That is a dangerous match, and Sheamus can be a dangerous guy to be in the ring with. I'm not saying he's sloppy or anything, but he can work stiff, and guys have gotten hurt working with him before. Anything can go wrong in a match like that. They had better hope and pray that Roman Reigns comes out of that match in one piece, because if something were to happen to him, they are fucked. Royally fucked. And it's because they still subscribe to this theory of building around just one guy. We can't make Roman and Dean look strong. No, we have to make Roman look strong. They build around one guy. There should be two or three guys. Or one guy and one girl. You know, why limit yourself to just one person? Especially if one of them gets hurt. Then what do? But this is how they operate. So they better hope he doesn't get hurt. Charlotte pinned Becky Lynch in a 4-minute match when she faked the knee injury and Ric Flair jumped up on the apron for the distraction. Charlotte then did a kip up to show that she wasn't really hurt. She rolled up Becky for the win. Distraction roll up number 20 for the year on Monday Night Raw, for those of you wondering where we are on the counter. Year's not over yet. The idea here was Charlotte is taking after her father as the dirtiest player in the game. It was also the first hint of a Charlotte heel turn, which is an idea I can get behind that. I can get behind that. I would get behind it even more had they just not done an angle on television trying to get her babyface sympathy because of her dead brother. Maybe they should think these things out a little bit better before they go and begin turning the person heel. Paige was on commentary claiming that she was right. She knew all along that Charlotte would stoop to cheating to win, just like her old man. And to the people who were saying, oh, Paige is a terrible heel, everything she said turned out to be true, some of the best heels are the ones who tell the truth. I mean, look at Chris Jericho in 2008. That's how it got started. He was telling the truth about Shawn Michaels. Shawn Michaels was faking a knee injury, and the people either didn't believe him or they didn't care. That's why he called them all hypocrites. But they liked Shawn Michaels so much that they could look past it. And it turned Jericho heel, and that was the best run of his career. Backstage, Becky confronted Charlotte. Charlotte said that what she did, she only did to help show Becky some tough love and teach her that she always has to be on guard. And they did their little pinky swear deal, and Charlotte walked off. We then had one of the worst segments on Raw I have seen all year. A pre-taped segment with Adam Rose called The Rose Bush that was supposed to be a takeoff of The Soup or Access Hollywood, one of these types of shows. It was him narrating bad jokes over clips of stuff from Raw. So narrating bad jokes over bad clips, basically. This was, in a word, horrendous. Now, the one thing I will give them credit for, on the one hand, is that they're trying to find something for Adam Rose to do instead of just firing the guy, which they could easily do. On the other hand, I only give them a little bit of credit. Why do I only give them a little bit of credit? Because if they want to do something with Adam Rose, then why the fuck didn't they do it after that ESPN special aired all those months ago? All of a sudden, now they're interested in finding something for Adam Rose. Man, nothing's working. We're trying everything with this guy, and it just won't work. Where the fuck were you 6 months ago when that goddamn ESPN special aired? I mean, it's stuff like this that pisses me off. So they have all of these meaningless guys on the roster that are just, I mean, they're so close to a pink slip they could taste it, and it's not even necessarily their fault. These are guys that have talent that could get over. And when an opportunity is dumped in their lap, it smacks them in the face. They shake it off like it never happened, and they let it pass them by. And then 6 months later, well, we probably should find something for this guy to do. What can we do? I know, we'll give him bad jokes that he could tell on TV. Oh, that'll get him over. I mean, this is what I'm talking about. It's like they don't have a creative bone in their bodies. It's not even a matter of being creative. You don't have to be that creative. Again, when the ESPN special aired, it wouldn't take a whole hell of a lot to put the guy out there under his real name, or he can keep the Adam Rose name, whatever, and just run with it. Let him be himself. Right? They say the best characters, it's just that person with the volume turned up. The problem with Adam Rose is they constantly have him trying to be something that he's not. So if we see another one of these segments, and I'm not even sure we will, if they knew what was good for them, they would cut it off right here and just be done with it and chalk it up to a bad idea. But even if they keep doing these, it's not going to last. This is not going to work. And eventually, it won't be Brad Maddox that we hear about as being wish well in his future endeavors. It'll be Adam Rose. And it's not his fault. New Day came out before the main event and said they were joining the League of Nations here on this night to make this a 7-on-4 match. So let's recap all of the New Day appearances on this show, because there were a lot of them. They opened the show by introducing Sheamus, the same Sheamus that they abandoned at Survivor Series, although apparently he's either a very forgiving man or Sheamus has early onset dementia and doesn't remember that they walked out on him. They then came back out to do commentary during the Usos Lucha Dragons match, and then interfered to cause the DQ. Then they were featured in a Cyber Monday ad for a WWE shop, hawking all their crap. And now they're back out for the main event. And I say this as somebody who loves the New Day. Right? I said last week on the podcast, where would this show be without the New Day? It's pretty scary. It's like The Shield in 2013. Where would this show be without The Shield and all those great matches? Not in good shape. So I am a big fan of the New Day. But what this proves is you can't, in fact, have too much of a good thing. They need to be careful with all of the New Day overexposure. Just dial it back a little bit. I don't want to see them kill the New Day. This match went 25 minutes. It should not have gone that long. Sheamus pinned Dean Ambrose, because of course he did. Couldn't pin one of the Usos, had to pin Ambrose. Pinned him after a brogue kick. They were beating up on Ambrose after the match until Reigns tried to make the save. He, too, was laid out with the brogue kick, and all the heels posed with their titles. Kevin Owens was the only champion, aside from Charlotte, who was not featured here. He was apparently supposed to be part of this main event. I don't know if that means he was going to be representing Canada in the League of Nations, which I think would be a terrible idea, because Kevin Owens, the Kevin Owens character does not strike me as somebody who should be fitting into a group like that. Kevin Owens works better, I think, as a man on his own. Or if he's going to do something for somebody, there's got to be an incentive in it for him. You know, like, we've seen him before shaking hands with Seth Rollins and shaking hands with Triple H, but I think it was always with the intent that, hey, I'm going to get a title shot, or I'm going to get this out of it, or I'm going to get that out of it. I don't see what the Kevin Owens character gets out of teaming with the champion and teaming with all of these bozos. So I'm actually happy he wasn't part of this, And I hope he isn't part of this, especially since it's only going to last maybe a month anyway. But he was out. Apparently, he got sick with the flu, and they sent him home, which I can relate to that. Then again, maybe he was just watching this show and got violently ill.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
NXT this past week opened with Baron Corbin and Ty Dillinger, a match that we were supposed to get, I think, a couple of weeks ago before Apollo Crews came out to attack Corbin. The match never happened. It was quick. Corbin made quick work of him, beat him with the End of Days. They did announce that it will be Samoa Joe and Baron Corbin as partners against Apollo Crews and Finn Balor this coming Wednesday on the Go Home show before the next takeover. Blue Pants was back, and they changed her music a little bit. It's no longer Colin Cassidy singing the theme to The Price is Right. They kind of have a more normal version of it. It's actually not as fun. But she was back. She got squashed by Nia Jax. Samoan drop, leg drop, 1, 2, 3. Not much to it. Tom Phillips was backstage. He conducted a sit-down interview with Dash and Dawson about their takeover match against Kaz and Enzo, who are getting a tag team championship match. And they said that they're going to take out Collins' other knee. That's what they threatened to do. I'm liking, you know, Dash and Dawson, the more I see them. I was not a fan at the beginning. They didn't do anything for me. But the more I see them, they remind me of just an old school, southern kind of badass tag team. And I'm digging it. I'm digging it. I don't know that it would ever work necessarily on the main roster, that they would be treated as anything other than a joke. But in NXT, they fit in quite well, and I enjoy their act. James Storm was back. He pinned Adam Rose, who I mentioned earlier. Adam Rose, just kind of there. He pinned him with the last call super kick. The announcers again brought up the fact that James Storm competed in WCW. And all the years that came after that, he was just an independent star, I guess, drifting from one place to the next. Another Sami Zayn returns vignette, this time with highlights of his NXT title win over Neville last December at TakeOver. Jason Jordan and Chad Gable beat the Vaudevillains. Good match here. Crowd very much into Jordan and Gable. And you know what I like about it? They're obviously into Gable. Gable is just fucking awesome. But it's rubbing off on Jason Jordan. So Jason Jordan now is getting his own chance. They're chanting his name as well. That would have never happened were it not for Chad Gable getting over the way he did. So this team is really clicking. It's working in every way, and it's the best thing that ever happened to Jason Jordan. So they win the match. No chivalry shown after the match by the Vaudevillains. Jordan and Gable put their hands out for a handshake. Vaudevillains thought about it for a second, and they decided against it. They turned around. They left. So, looks like a heel turn may be coming for the Vaudevillains. I'm really not sure what you do with them now anyway. You know, again, if they promote them, I mentioned Dash and Dawson before. I mean, Dash and Dawson have a better shot of getting over on the main roster than these guys do. These guys, if they get promoted to the main roster, they will die a horrible death. Okay, I'm calling that one from a mile away. If the Vaudevillains get called up, it is over. I mean, it'll be like a second coming of the Ascension up there on the main roster for them. Emma beat Liv Morgan with the Emma Lock. Liv Morgan is a beautiful girl. I said the same thing last time she showed up on TV with a different name. Then she was called Marley. They changed her name again. Now it's Liv Morgan. I don't care what they change her name to. They could change her name to Ugly. She would still be beautiful. After the match, they showed Asuka kicking a giant punching bag on the big screen. She told Emma she would see her at TakeOver in a very menacing way. Fans chanted, "Asuka's gonna kill you," because she will. Backstage, their new interviewer, Alex Reyes is his name, who appeared no less than 4 times on the show, by the way. He spoke with Bayley backstage. She said she would be willing to accept the challenge of Nia Jax if a title shot is what she wanted. I guess that's what she wanted, because Nia Jax showed up and she threw Bayley through a door that collapsed. And Bayley was laid out on the floor. Main event was Samoa Joe against Tommaso Ciampa. The announcers mentioned their history together outside of NXT. They even said that Joe introduced Ciampa to his wife. which is very nice of him. Unfortunately for him, though, they said their friendship was not enough to stop Joe from murdering him here in 2015. This was a great match. This was the best NXT main event I've seen in a long time. And this was the Samoa Joe from Ring of Honor. This is the closest thing to old school Samoa Joe, Ring of Honor, early TNA that we have seen since he came over here to WWE. He is great in this role of just pissed off badass. These two guys, both of them, I mean, Ciampa as well deserves a lot of credit because he had a great match. And they had an exchange here where they were giving each other some hard open slaps. You could see the sweat flying off their face. It's just brutal. Brutal stuff. Got a chant of "This is awesome," which is such a played out chant, but I think it was well deserved here for that spot. There was a running snap power slam that Joe did at one point. I have not seen him do this, not recently anyway. It was kind of similar to what you see Goldust do, and it's very impressive to see Goldust doing his thing at age 44 or 45, whatever he is. Goldust does that very quick suplex, the scoop power slam kind of when somebody runs at him. This was different. Joe was the one who was running. So Joe is running toward his opponent when he scooped him up and slammed him. It was very impressive. Muscle Buster into the choke for the win. He screamed for Balor when the match was over. This was as good as Samoa Joe has looked since he debuted in May. And I'll tell you what, if it were me, I'd put the title on him at TakeOver. If I'm booking this, Samoa Joe wins the NXT Championship and nearly kills Balor after the match. I don't care how he does it, if he has to cheat or whatever, but he wins. And winning is not enough. He's just killing Balor when the match is over. And all of a sudden, I'd have Hideo Itami make the save. Assuming Hideo is ready to come back. He's supposed to be ready right around now. I don't know if he is or not, but if he is, I would have Hideo make the save and do the big reveal that it was Samoa Joe who attacked him all those months ago. And it makes sense because Joe debuted the very same night that Itami was attacked in the parking lot. And so if you do that, you've now set up your first feud for him, for Joe that is, in 2016 for the title. What you've also done is you've freed up Finn Balor for a possible main roster debut. If you want to do that at the Royal Rumble, you could put the Demon in the Royal Rumble match as a surprise. And Finn Balor is one of the few people from NXT that I'm actually not too concerned about in terms of going to the main roster. I think they have a lot invested in him and his big entrance. They wouldn't just do that for anybody. I think there may be some bumps in the road, as there usually are for these guys, but I think he'll be okay once he goes to the main roster. So, God knows they could use some more depth up there right now. I like Balor, and Balor's very talented. I can't say that him as NXT champion is lighting my world on fire. So, like I said, I would pull the trigger. Joe is just firing on all cylinders right now. I would do the title change. I would do the reveal so he and Itami can feud and have, at least one, if not a couple of big matches together. And that frees up Balor for the Rumble. That's how I would do it. Quick note on TNA's soon-to-be former home. Destination America is going to be rebranding itself as a paranormal channel. Which, if it's going to rebrand itself as a paranormal channel, TNA should just stay. I mean, they fit right in. Apparently, they did some live exorcism a while back that did big numbers on the network, so they're going to be doing similar types of stuff 7 nights a week starting next fall. It did big numbers, but it was a huge letdown in that nothing apparently happened during this exorcism. People felt ripped off, and they didn't even pay for it. Bubba Ray Dudley went on Twitter at the time, and he referred to the host as dog shit and a fraud. So some strong words right there. Didn't Kofi Kingston do a live Ghost Hunters show once or something? Or maybe it was Elijah Burke. I don't remember, but that's Ghost Hunters. That's different. This was an exorcism. The first thing Destination America did was exorcise TNA and Ring of Honor from its channel. By the way, TNA is now live streaming classic episodes of Impact on their YouTube channel every Thursday night from 7 to 8 p.m. Eastern. They started with the very first episode this week of NWA TNA. I tuned in, I saw a couple of guys dressed in flesh-tone costumes called the Johnsons, and I immediately turned it off. But if that's your thing, you can watch all the old TNA that your heart desires every Thursday on their YouTube channel. One last thing here. I didn't see Ring of Honor, so I can't talk about it. But one last thing before we move on to the mailbag. On their Facebook page this week, the Stardom promotion in Japan posted a very sad update on the career of Act Yasukawa. Now, you may remember me talking about this story, so I wanted to give an update. Act Yasukawa is the woman who was brutally beaten in the ring by another wrestler named Yoshiko, who has since been rightfully blackballed from the business. She should have been incarcerated as well for what she did. It's too bad that she wasn't. She fractured the woman's nasal cavity. She fractured her orbital socket, which is important because Yasukawa had something called Graves' disease that she had battled for much of her life that affects her vision. And she had just had successful surgery to restore vision in her right eye only a few months before this match. And then Yoshiko goes and fractures her orbital socket. Now, that happened in February. And she had multiple surgeries and months of rehab. She was finally able to make her big comeback in September. She came back. But the vision in that same eye that had been fixed the year before is now damaged to the point where I believe she is... she might mostly be blind in that eye, and the doctors tell her that her vision is not gonna, is never going to come back to what it once was. And as a result of that, she has been forced to announce her retirement from wrestling. Not even 30 years old, and her career has come to an end. So she's going to be wrestling her last match on December 23rd. It's very, very sad. I think they ought to reinstate Yoshiko for one night and let her wrestle Act in Act's final match, but she has to do so with both arms tied behind her back and her ankles taped together, and let's see how she likes it. Let's get to the mailbag. If you have questions, you can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Derek, with the news of Kurt Angle retiring from Impact Wrestling next month, how would you feel about a potential return to WWE for a match against Triple H at WrestleMania 32? They could even play off the real-life rumors of Triple H not wanting to sign Angle to a contract last year. There could be dueling promos where Kurt says Triple H tried to keep him away from WWE because he's always been jealous of him, and Triple H could talk about how much of a liability and a burden he is to have on the roster, or something along those lines. It may not be enough to get 100,000 people in the stadium, but it could still be a big draw. I don't know that I would have Triple H out there calling Angle basically a nutcase or a burden to have on the roster. I wouldn't do that, but I would be okay with that match. To be honest with you, it may be the safest match that Kurt could have. Safer than Brock. You know, maybe they could even work Stephanie in there and they could play off the old love triangle stuff. I'd be down for that. A lot of guys I'd like to see Kurt in the ring with for a WrestleMania match, they're on the shelf right now. You know, Daniel Bryan, Randy Orton, Seth Rollins, all of them would be great opponents for Kurt Angle. Especially Bryan or Rollins, I think. So, you know, Triple H would be as big of a name as anybody, and it's somebody that Angle could beat, right? There's no harm in having Kurt Angle beat Triple H. But then again, I said the same thing about Sting earlier this year. We see how that turned out. Travis from Somerset, Wisconsin. I recently decided to end my subscription to the WWE Network because outside of Daniel Bryan and The Rock, or Brock, Undertaker stuff, there has not been a decent payoff for any storyline that they were pushing, and the recent shows finally broke the camel's back. Outside of those two, can you think of three storylines over the last 5 years that satisfied you? Not just having a great match, but a good story and a good payoff with it. If you can think of three, I will renew my subscription for another month. Well, I don't give a shit what you do. You can subscribe or not. It doesn't affect me, but, you know... There's really only one that comes to mind. It's the Authority storyline with Cody and Goldust that built... It built up for a couple of months because Cody had a match with Randy Orton on Raw, and I think Randy Orton beat him. Goldust came back, had a match with Orton. Orton beat him. And it all built to the Rhodes brothers teaming up and beating The Shield at Battleground to keep their jobs, right? The good guys won in the end, which is a rare feat in WWE these days. That's honestly the only one I could think of. How sad is that? That's the only one I could think of. And that may be one of the biggest problems with WWE right now. You know, this company has been so heel-dominated for so long. I mean, look at their roll call of champions right now. They're all heels. Every single one of them. Sheamus is a heel. Kevin Owens is a heel. Alberto Del Rio is a heel. The New Day are heels. You know, they're supposed to be anyway when they're not making you laugh. Charlotte. Charlotte is technically the lone babyface, but even she started a heel turn on Monday, so I consider her a heel after what she did to Becky Lynch. I think that's the direction they're going in. She's probably going to end up being a full-fledged heel. I mean, the authority always wins, aside from that one little storyline I mentioned, which was from 2 years ago. They always win. That one storyline, and the time that Vicky Guerrero pushed Stephanie McMahon into the little pool of pudding or whatever the hell it was, I can't think of a single victory that anybody has had against the authority. That actually stuck. So not a case where they beat them, but then the authority gets them back 2 weeks later. I can't think of anything else. Like I said, even if the babyfaces get a win over them, you know that in the end they're always going to win the war. They lost at Survivor Series last year. They were gone. And they came right back 5 weeks later. And not only did they come back 5 weeks later, what did they do? They punished everybody. They fired most of the top babyfaces in that one stupid storyline. You look at the world title right now, okay? The world champion. It's Sheamus. Now, before Sheamus, it was Roman Reigns for 5 minutes. But really, it was Seth Rollins, okay? He was the champion before that. We had Rollins as the champion going back to WrestleMania, so he was the champ for most of the year. Before him, it was Brock Lesnar, another heel. Before Brock, you'd have to go back to SummerSlam last year. It was John Cena with the title, who's practically a heel anyway. Fine. Cena. We had Cena. Cena as the babyface champion for 2 months. Before that, I think it was Daniel Bryan. He had the title for 2 months. Before him, it was Randy Orton, another heel, who was the champion for months. So, for the most part, the world title has largely been dominated by heel champions for the better part of 2 years now. And there is something to be said for the chase. You want to have the champion, you know, as the heel and the babyface chases him, right? Okay, there is something to be said for that. The problem in WWE, it seems to me, is that all the babyfaces ever do is chase. They never actually catch up to anybody. And then when they do, they end up getting screwed over somehow. Every week, for months on end, Raw opens with the heel coming out to cut a 20-minute promo on all of us, the heel champion. Or how many fucking times has Raw opened with the authority? A heel faction. I think they're supposed to be heels anyway. It's hard to tell. They go back and forth so much. Only the Bella Twins are worse than Triple H and Stephanie when it comes to that. I have no fucking clue what Nikki and Brie are supposed to ever be. This past week, Brie Bella was back to being a babyface. Okay. Whatever. Who could possibly care? You know, Donald Trump. What is it that he's always blabbing about on television? We never win anymore. This country, we don't win. We have no victories. Right? That's all I ever hear him saying. It's the same shit over and over again. Well, that's like WWE these days. That's like all the baby faces in WWE. Nobody ever wins. The bad guys always get the last laugh. I mean, no wonder so many people have turned the show off. It's fucking depressing. It's no fun to watch when the bad guys always win. I mean, the periods that saw the greatest success in the history of that company, the Hulkamania era, the Austin era, even the early part of the Cena era, what did they all have in common? A dominant babyface champion. So you could say what you want to about the chase, but Hogan had that title for 4 years before he lost it. And business was booming. Austin did lose the title a few times, but at no point did you have, you know, like Ministry Undertaker or Rock as the corporate champion holding the title for more than a few months. Austin would always win the belt back, or he would do something to make the heels look like fools. You know, same when Rock was the top babyface when Austin was gone in 2000. You know, Rock and Triple H would trade the belt back and forth. It wasn't like Triple H had the championship for the entire year. John Cena, the same thing. There was one point where John Cena had the title, I think, for over a year, and he only lost it because he got hurt. But then you look at Triple H's reign of terror from 2002 on Raw, 2002-2003, maybe the least amount of fun until this year that I've ever had watching Raw. It's no fun when the bad guys always win and you have very few good moments. we don't really have much to celebrate anymore, do we? It's no wonder people are being chased away in droves. That's no fun. Why would people want to watch that? That may be one of the biggest problems right now in WWE. Ben from Huddersfield, England. The night after WrestleMania 29, The Rock was due to appear on Raw. Then they announced that The Rock injured himself at WrestleMania and would not be on the show. Even Booker T came out and said this. Was this fake? And also, was Brock Lesnar due to fight The Rock at Extreme Rules 2013? Well, no. I mean, the injuries were very real. He tore, I think, like every muscle in his body. It was like he tore this and he tore that. So he was hurt. And him and Brock were not going to wrestle at Extreme Rules. The plan was for Brock to attack The Rock, probably lay him out with an F5. And they were going to fire that first shot to set up a match at WrestleMania 30 the following year. And they would kind of have the entire year to build it up. So that was the plan, but Rock got hurt and it just screwed everything up. Reggie from Manhattan. On a regular basis, Kevin Dunn gets joked on by both fans and wrestlers alike due to his looks and negative influence towards the WWE product. However, he has had, or has he had, he wants to know, any positive influence in WWE in any aspect? And what will his legacy be when he retires, a.k.a. is buried by Triple H? Well, look, I mean, Kevin Dunn obviously is good at what he does. He's had the job for as long as he has, I think. In large part, you know, the story about his father used to work for Vince or Vince Sr. and one night saved a bunch of tapes from a fire and, you know, Vince was always indebted to him and, you know, take care of my son. I mean, I've told the story before. That's largely why he's had a job for so long and why Vince McMahon is so loyal to him all these years. But the fact is, you know, WWE has always been known for having these great production values and that kind of stuff. If you're going to give them credit for that, then you got to give credit to Kevin Dunn, because Kevin Dunn is the head of production. You know, he's the head cheese. He oversees all of that. He's not necessarily the one who deserves credit whenever there's a great video package or something, because he has a lot of very talented people underneath him who work on that kind of stuff. But if you're going to give credit to WWE for their great production and their great production values, then Kevin Dunn deserves credit for overseeing all of it. So I won't sit here and say he's had no positive influence on the product. I think he's had a lot of positive influence. I just happen to think, based on all the stories we hear about him and all of the influence that he clearly has over Vince, he has Vince's ear, and Vince puts a lot of faith and trust into this guy. And that goddamn shaky cam that he seems to be so fond of these days, I think he's probably done way more harm than good, especially in recent years. I think he's one of the old dinosaurs in that company that has to go. I think Kevin Dunn is one of the people who has to go. He no longer belongs there. I think the product, I think, could benefit from having a fresh face, from having fresh ideas, from having somebody new at the helm. Will somebody new be worse than him? Maybe. But I would rather WWE take a chance and get somebody new in there. To me, Kevin Dunn is one of the old dinosaurs, one of the old farts, who no longer has a place in WWE. And the product being as blasé as it is, and as boring and as bad, look, he's not the one coming up with storylines or anything like that. You can't lay that at the feet of Kevin Dunn. But I think he's not part of the solution, he's part of the problem. And I think the quicker they get rid of him, or if Triple H is the one who supposedly isn't fond of him, if Triple H is the one to get rid of him, great. I hope he does. I hope the minute that Vince is out of the picture, Triple H boots his ass on out of there. Because I think at this point, he's one of those people that's it's probably doing more harm than good. It's probably a lot of older guys behind the scenes and Vince's right-hand men and all that kind of stuff who probably also need to get the boot, quite frankly. I think they need to start fresh. And they could start with Kevin Dunn. Jason from Ronkonkoma, New York. Are the Young Bucks really as good as everyone thinks, or is it all just hype? I've seen them in person a few times, and I am a fan, so I am on the side of them being good. How would WWE handle them, and could they be successful? You know, I hear that a lot from people, too. The Young Bucks are all hype. It's just a bunch of super kicks and spots. They're a bunch of spot monkeys. To me, these people don't know what they're talking about. I also have seen the Young Bucks, not just on TV or in Ring of Honor or New Japan. I've seen them in person. I was at an independent show a few months ago. They were in the main event. I saw them come out and interact with the fans and have a damn good match that wasn't just super kicks. Yes, they do a lot of super kicks. That's their shtick. That's their act. That doesn't mean that's all they can do. You know, they got to the level they're at. They got over by being good wrestlers and busting their ass. I remember when they first showed up in Ring of Honor, and I, like a lot of people, looked at them and went, man, what a bunch of Hardy Boys ripoffs. This is just a modern-day incarnation of Matt and Jeff. They're ripping off the Hardy Boys. Hardy Boys 2.0. And it didn't take very long for them to bust out of that and, you know, create their own identity and get over on their own. They didn't just do that by kicking people in the face. That's become their hallmark. That's become their trademark. But I think it's flat wrong for people to say that they're all hype and they have no talent. They have plenty of talent. They're very good wrestlers. They, like Hulk Hogan, for example, are very adept at knowing what they need to do to satisfy their audience. When people see the Young Bucks, they want to see super kicks. They want to see the super kick party and all that kind of stuff. They know that. They know their audience very well. Just like Hulk Hogan. Hulk Hogan knew his audience very well. And he knew he didn't have to go out there and do high spots. He didn't have to be like John Cena and try to bust out a hurricanrana every now and then just to impress people. He can go out there. He could sell for the big guy. He can do the Hogan comeback. He could cup his ear. He could pose. And he can go home. Because that's all people in this country wanted to see. Now, when he went to Japan, again, Hogan was very smart. You watch a Hulk Hogan match in Japan, it's not the same Hulk Hogan you would see here in the U.S. Okay? Not that he was doing high spots there either, but he was actually wrestling. You know, people would say, is Hulk Hogan all hype? No, Hulk Hogan could wrestle. He knew how to wrestle. He was just smart enough to know that there were things he didn't have to do. When he went to Japan, he felt he had to do it. So you would see him do a drop toe hold, and you would see him do this, and you would see him do that. And it's like, holy shit, it's like a completely different person. I think the Young Bucks are similar in that respect. They know what they need to do. You know, maybe sometimes they don't go above and beyond that. Sometimes they do. But to say they're not good wrestlers is just, it's completely fucking stupid. They're great. You know, I dig them. They don't bother me. Now, how would WWE handle them? WWE would fucking bury them 6 feet under. I think WWE or Triple H or whoever it is are probably very annoyed that they haven't been able to get the Young Bucks. I think they've probably made a play for them before. And the Young Bucks, to their credit, you know, they've got a good thing going on with Ring of Honor. They've got a good thing going on with New Japan. And they're in the Bullet Club. And they came to this great contract with Ring of Honor a few months ago that allows them to keep doing the New Japan stuff and that allows them to keep doing PWG. They're very loyal to PWG. That's where they kind of grew up and really made a name for themselves. And they were able to get a pretty sweet contract, which I assume between all of the different promotions they're working for, you know, they're making good money. They didn't feel the need to have to go to WWE. Oh, we have to go to WWE. We have to feed our families. And I think that's a great credit to them, and maybe one day they will end up in WWE. But I think if they were to go there now, I think there's a lot that would be held against them. And don't think for a second that every now and then when you hear JBL use the word, the phrase superkick party on TV, or everyone's doing superkicks, don't think that doesn't have something to do with the Young Bucks, because it does. And they can be a very petty company. But if they went to WWE, not that the fans wouldn't be into them. I mean, if they pushed them and they let them be themselves, they'd get over in a heartbeat. In NXT, they would be gods. But it wouldn't take very long for WWE to bury them 6 feet under. There's not a doubt in my mind they would be buried under so much dirt in WWE, they're better off not being there. Corey from New Jersey. What's the most impressive finish a superstar had to a match after legitimately being injured in it? Some that come to mind are Triple H tearing his quad on Raw, Triple H getting his throat crushed during the first Elimination Chamber, Undertaker being burned by pyro and literally burning in the chamber pods, and Mankind during the Hell in a Cell match at King of the Ring in 98. What is the most impressive one to you? They're all impressive. I mean, if somebody gets hurt during a match and they finish the match, I mean, maybe it's a stupid thing for them to do, but it's pretty fucking impressive. You know, they're all impressive. Every single one you mentioned. But of the ones that you mentioned, if I had to pick one, I have no idea to this day how Mick Foley finished that match off after he fell the first time, let alone the second time. But one that you left off, and this is the one I'm going with. This is my pick. I'm going with Vader. I'm going with Vader's eyeball popping out of its socket during that match in Japan with Stan Hansen. And he just popped that shit back in with his fingers, and he beat the fuck out of Stan Hansen. Both of them beat the fuck out of each other. Actually, the minute Vader came to the ring, Hansen hit him in the face with a cowbell, and I think he broke Vader's nose. That was before the match even started. And the match went like another 15 minutes after his eye popped out. That's a boss right there. Dude's eye came out, and he still finished the match. So, Vader wins. Andre from Louisiana. Who is the most popular member of DX? I would go with Road Dogg or China. Triple H was so-so, and X-Pac was hot until he turned on Kane. Are you trying to tell me that Triple H had to surround himself with people more over than he was and more charismatic than he was just to make himself look better? Is that what you're telling me? Because I can't believe it. I just can't believe it. Yes, I would say the Outlaws and China were probably the most popular members of DX at their at each of their peak of popularity. I think that's fair to say. China probably more than all of them, but the Outlaws were right behind her. Anthony from Las Vegas. I have been rewatching WWF from 1998 and didn't realize how over Triple H and Rock were heading into SummerSlam 98. How different do you think things would have gone for Triple H and Rock had Triple H not messed up his knee on Heat before the match? Would Rock have won the title at Survivor Series? Would it take until early 2000 for Triple H to be taken seriously as a top guy? I was not aware that Triple H messed up his knee on Heat. I always thought he messed it up during the actual ladder match, but you may be right. I don't know where you heard that from. I don't think it would have changed things much at all. Triple H would have had a nice little run with the Intercontinental title. And Rock, you know, Rock was so over, he would have won the title at Survivor Series anyway. I think the people were ready to cheer for him. And so he would have gone on to become a babyface right after that match, just like he did. I think after SummerSlam, Rock and Triple H were going to go their separate ways anyway. You know, the feud was pretty much played out by that point. So Rock would have won the world title, Triple H would have done his thing with the Intercontinental title, and probably turned heel around WrestleMania just like he did when he joined the corporation. And yes, it would have taken until early 2000 to really take him seriously as a top guy. I mean, me anyway, I'm not going to speak for everybody. I speak for myself when I say that I didn't take the guy seriously as like a real main eventer until that street fight he had with Mick Foley at the Royal Rumble. So, you know, if he didn't fuck up his knee in 98, you know, in that match, would that have changed things? I don't think so. John from California. Buy or sell, who had the better title run? Bret Hart in 1994 or Shawn Michaels in 1996? Both runs seemed identical, starting off with their Royal Rumble win, then winning the WWE title at WrestleMania, and each ending at Survivor Series. Well, they are very similar when you put it like that. They are very similar. I am going to give the slight edge to Shawn Michaels because I think his best matches that year in 96 were just a shade better than Bret's best in 94. And I say that as a huge Bret Hart fan, especially from that period. I fucking loved Bret Hart's matches that year. The title defense against the 1-2-3 Kid on Raw, the title defense against Bob Backlund on Superstars, which I included in my top 8 countdown a few weeks ago, so everybody knows how much I love that match. His cage match with Owen Hart at SummerSlam in 94 is still one of my favorite steel... It may still be my favorite steel cage match. Just straight up steel cage match ever in WWE. And there was no blood, you know, which a lot of cage matches, especially back then, you know, there was blood involved and everything. It was just a great match. I love that match. I love the mayhem after that match at ringside with all the family members. But Shawn beat Bret in the Iron Man match at WrestleMania, which I think is overrated. Let me just say that. I think that Iron Man match is so overrated, it's not even funny. I'm not saying it's a bad match. I'm just saying people make it out to be more special than it really was. But he did beat Bret in the Iron Man match to win the championship. So that was a big match in 96. And that was also much better than Bret Hart's match with Yokozuna, where he won the belt at WrestleMania 10. Sean went from the Iron Man match the very next month. He had that great no-holds-barred match against Diesel. Probably Diesel's best match. He had a fantastic match with Mankind at that Mind Game show. And even the match with Sid when he lost the title at Survivor Series. That was one of the best Sid matches I've ever seen. And the crowd was great. Crowd hated Shawn Michaels that night. It made for a great atmosphere in the Garden that night. Bret Hart's Survivor Series match where he lost the title to Bob Backlund was just the complete opposite of the match they had on Superstars a few months earlier. This match was just boring as all hell. It was awful. Not as bad as their WrestleMania 11 match, but it was still pretty bad. So I'm going to give Shawn the slight edge. I'm going to buy on Shawn in 96, and I'm going to sell on Bret in 94. Durrell from Ohio has a buy or sell for us. Buy or sell. Triple H putting Rob Van Dam over at Unforgiven 2002, or putting Booker T over at WrestleMania 19. Well, given the storyline, it should have been Booker T, but if you're asking me who I would have put over and who I would have given the chance to run with the belt, I think as popular as he was at that time, I'd have gone with RVD. I'm going to buy on RVD and I'm going to sell on Booker T. You know, Van Dam was over as hell back then. I know Seth Mates, who worked on the creative team at the time, he's talked about the plan that they came up with to have Triple H and RVD meet up to crown the very first World Heavyweight Champion, and Rob Van Dam would have won that match. And the plan was then he would hold it until WrestleMania the following year, and then maybe they would do like a champion against champion RVD versus Brock Lesnar match, which doesn't feel like a WrestleMania main event to me, but that was the plan they came up with. Obviously, they didn't go with that plan. That ended up not happening. They handed the title to Triple H out of a briefcase instead. I think RVD was still going to win the title. I think there was a plan, even then, to have Van Dam beat Triple H at Unforgiven when they met for the championship. Triple H, as the story goes, supposedly convinced Vince that RVD was not the right guy for the role. Let's have Rick do the turn, and Ric Flair will go with Triple H and be his manager, and Triple H will win. So that's what they did. They kept the title on Triple H. You know, it's like, imagine if Vince McMahon was on trial against the government in 2002 the way that he was in 1994. But this time, the judge assigned to the case was Paul Levesque. And he didn't recuse himself from the case. You know, that'd be one hell of a conflict of interest to have, wouldn't it? Yeah, it's like, if there was a big job promotion that I was up for, and it was between me and one other guy, and I found out that the other guy was sitting in on meetings with management where they were talking about who should get the job and why, and I wasn't invited to those meetings, I would be fucking infuriated. I feel that same way about all those times we hear stories of Triple H sitting in on production meetings, giving input into his own storylines and his own match finishes. Yeah, it's like, if you're going to do that, at least have the other guy in the room, too, to make his own case as to why he thinks he deserves to win. A lot of those Triple H opponents, they didn't have that luxury. It's bad enough, you know, Triple H at the time was dating the boss's daughter. So obviously there was some level of influence there, but now he's sitting in on these meetings? I mean, apparently he was sitting in on meetings going as far back as like 97, 98, long before he ever got involved with Stephanie, because Vince, you know, he offered, and Vince obviously thought highly of him, so him sitting in on production meetings was not something new that only happened after he started dating Stephanie. But between the two things, it's like, man, you know, these Triple H opponents, they didn't stand a chance. You know, it's actually quite sad. Ryan from Berkshire County, Massachusetts, buy or sell Undertaker's 2002 heel run or Eddie Guerrero's 2005 heel run? Both are probably the most unnecessary and damaging heel turns of the Ruthless Aggression era. I wouldn't say that. I liked Big Evil Undertaker in 2002. And Big Evil is different than the American Badass. So they're not exactly the same thing. But I like Big Evil. You know, I'm going to buy on him and I'm going to sell on Eddie. And I'll tell you why. I didn't really like how they did the actual turn with The Undertaker, where he admitted that he kissed Vince McMahon's ass just like everybody else, and then he double-crossed Jim Ross. That was very weak. Undertaker should not be saying something like that. He should not be admitting that he kissed anybody's ass. But were it not for heel Undertaker that year in 02, there's a ton of things that we never would have gotten that year. And I jotted a few of them down. You know, when I saw the question here and I started thinking about it, I just quickly jotted a few things down. And I'm looking at this and I'm going, man, there were a lot of things I liked about The Undertaker's heel run that year. And there could be some that I'm missing here. These are just the ones I initially scribbled down. But I'm going to make the case for why heel Undertaker was a positive thing. As brief as it was, he wasn't a heel for that long. But I think it was a positive thing. So, for example, we would never have gotten Maven eliminating him from the Royal Rumble, which is one of the all-time great Rumble moments. The way they pulled that off and the way the fans responded and everything, it was great. And it was a truly shocking moment that nobody saw coming. Okay, nobody expected that. So we wouldn't have gotten that. We wouldn't have gotten the match with Ric Flair at WrestleMania. And the match itself was not that good. But the match actually gave us two great moments. Okay, one was in the build-up, where he went to the training center, he hunted down David Flair, and he beat him up in the shower. That was great. I maintain to this day that was great. You know, he's sitting beside David Flair after kicking his ass in the shower. And David's like, what are you doing? And The Undertaker just goes, I'm kicking your ass. What does it look like I'm doing? I can't. When I watch that on YouTube, I can't not laugh when I watch that. So we wouldn't have gotten that. The other moment that we wouldn't have gotten had it not been for the Flair match was that picture-perfect Arn Anderson spinebuster, which I think was the last great spinebuster, maybe the last spinebuster of Arn Anderson's career. Made that whole fucking match for me, that one move. We had the promo with Ric Flair on Raw, where Flair was there to award the new Undisputed belt to Triple H after he beat Jericho at WrestleMania. And the crowd, Undertaker was out there, and the crowd was giving Undertaker the what treatment, which is something you don't do to The Undertaker. And I'm sure you all remember the greatest response ever to that awful, awful chant when The Undertaker said, say what if you sleep with your sister? And the inbred morons said, what? And then they realized what they did and they booed. And The Undertaker just shook his head in disgust. Because what else are you going to do? That was a truly great Raw moment. Hulk Hogan, by the way, had the second greatest response ever to the what chant. When the crowd chanted what at him, and he goes, "Cha gonna do?" I have to say that was very clever. Not as clever as The Undertaker, but still very clever. Speaking of Hogan, his match with The Undertaker at that Judgment Day show in 2002 was negative stars. Okay, that's how bad it was. But it was almost worth it for getting to see The Undertaker tying Hulk Hogan's legs to the back of his motorcycle and literally dragging him through the entire backstage area. It was so absurd, you couldn't help but laugh and enjoy watching The Undertaker drag Hulk Hogan around all over the backstage area. He did have that title match at the King of the Ring with Triple H, which was the worst match I've ever seen the two of them have together. It was an atrocious match. But we also got two of Undertaker's best matches during that heel period. The ladder match on Raw with Jeff Hardy for the championship was a great match. I think that match did more to legitimize Jeff Hardy than anything else up to that point in his career. He came this close to beating The Undertaker and winning the championship and then fell just a little bit short. And then after the match, even though he was the heel, Undertaker gave Jeff Hardy his props. He shook his hand. He showed him respect. That was very cool. And by the way, that's how you make a star. So I thought that was, what he did for Jeff Hardy, not just in the match, but after the match, was tremendous. I thought that was a cool moment. And then the other great match that Undertaker was part of during that period, and this was right before he turned babyface, was the triple threat match at Vengeance. It was Undertaker, Kurt Angle, and The Rock. And that was the match where Undertaker lost the championship to The Rock. And The Rock really was just a transitional champion because he turned around and lost it to Brock Lesnar the very next month. That is still one of the greatest triple threat matches I've ever seen. You can say that the turn that Undertaker did was unnecessary if you want to, and some people cheered him anyway because he's the Undertaker. Just like Steve Austin. When Steve Austin turned heel, plenty of people still cheered him. But I think The Undertaker made the most of that heel run. I liked it more than the Ministry stuff he did. Now, Eddie is a heel in 05 with the Dominic stuff. I'm with you on that. I thought it was stupid. Eddie could be a great heel. Make no mistake about it. The promo he cut after he turned on Rey Mysterio and he held his mask up, that was tremendous. One of the all-time great Eddie Guerrero promos, I thought. The custody storyline, though, and having a ladder match for custody of Rey Mysterio's kid was Russo-level stupidity. Like Judy Bagwell on a pole type of stupidity. And that may be the biggest difference, I think, between the two. Undertaker and Eddie Guerrero were two baby faces that were so beloved, people almost couldn't bring themselves to boo them. But Undertaker had some real good stuff to sink his teeth into, whereas Eddie, I thought it was just dumb. I mean, they didn't give him hardly anything to work with. You know, had he turned on Batista like I think he would have if he didn't die, he was in the middle of this partnership with Batista, this friendship with him on camera. If they would have had him turn on Batista, maybe he could have made that work because they seem to be building to that for a while. But when I think about Eddie in those Ruthless Aggression years, it's the team with Chavo and the skits they did and the match with Brock and winning the world title and celebrating in the ring with Benoit at Madison Square Garden. Those are the moments I think of, not the silly stuff he did with Rey Mysterio in 05. So that's why I'm going to buy on Taker's heel run in 02, and I'm selling on Eddie's heel run in 05. And we will end this week with a match anatomy. This is timely, given the release of the Owen Hart DVD this Tuesday, December 8th. The Owen Hart DVD is being released. I was homesick this week, and so part of what I decided to do, besides watching the commish all day, was I did manage to watch some stuff on the network. I watched some of the new stuff they've put up. They've put up old NWA Saturday Night stuff and World Class and I think AWA. Like, they got some pretty cool old school stuff that they've put up. But I just decided, okay, I want to watch a pay-per-view, and I settled on Survivor Series 1993. I'm still in the Survivor Series spirit. So I decided to watch the 93 Survivor Series, and this week's Match Anatomy is the Hart brothers, Brett, Owen, Bruce, and Keith, against Shawn Michaels and his Royal Knights in a Survivor Series traditional elimination match. Now, you might ask yourself, why the hell was Shawn Michaels teaming up with a bunch of knights? What the hell does that have to do with anything? Well, it's because Shawn Michaels originally was not supposed to be in this match. It was supposed to be Bret Hart and his family against Jerry Lawler and his knights, and that would make more sense, having the knights teaming up with the king. Jerry Lawler had been feuding with Bret for months. He had been railing on Stu and Helen and the entire family for months, and so this was going to be the big match. And then Jerry Lawler was indicted. He was indicted on charges of raping a 15-year-old girl. And so that took him out of the picture for a while. He was actually off television for several months until those legal troubles got cleared up. I think the girl ended up recanting part of her story or admitting she made part of it up. Anyway, the charges did eventually get dropped. Lawler, I think, made his return at WrestleMania 10 doing commentary with Vince McMahon. But that happened. He was indicted on those charges before Survivor Series. So they bounced him out of that match. Shawn Michaels had his own stuff going on at the time. If you remember, he had been the Intercontinental Champion, but then all of a sudden he disappeared. He got suspended, and they had a Battle Royal, and Razor Ramon won the Intercontinental title. Shawn came back, and then they ended up doing the storyline where they had they each had an Intercontinental title that they called their own, and they had the ladder match that led to the ladder match at WrestleMania 10. So Shawn, in reality, had been suspended for failing a steroid test. And so he had been suspended and off television for at least a couple of months. And I don't know if he was due to come back or if they decided to bring him back because they needed to fill that spot because Lawler wasn't going to be able to do it. So Lawler left. Shawn was reinstated, and that's why it was him and the Knights. It really didn't make any sense. They at least tried to tie things together, like in the promo before the match, Shawn. They brought up the fact that him and Brett had a history. It was a year earlier at Survivor Series 1992 that They wrestled, which was amazing at that time, if you think about it, because WWF, you know, even the early 90s, was still the land of the giants, and it was about the big man. And things happened. Warrior got fired. Bulldog got fired. They really started to crack down on the drugs and the steroids. They got serious as Vince McMahon up to that point had ever been about it, because there was a lot of heat on him from the government. And all of a sudden, smaller guys got opportunities like Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels. And you had a Survivor Series pay-per-view in 92 that was headlined by a champion versus champion match, Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels. I mean, that was unheard of at that time in WWE. So here we are a year later. They're at least trying to tie it back to that in the history that Shawn has with Bret. Shawn's teaming with these knights. Greg Valentine was one of the knights. It was the Red Knight, the White Knight, and the Blue Knight. Greg Valentine was the Blue Knight, for those of you who do go back and watch the match. And it's very obvious, just based on his body type and his mannerisms, that it's Greg Valentine. Barry Horowitz was the Red Knight. And I actually could not remember the name of the third knight, so I looked it up. The consensus seems to be that the White Knight was a guy named Jeff Gaylord, who had been a WWF jobber at the time. Some people to this day still think it was a young Glenn Jacobs, but they got a close-up of the guy's face when the Knights come out to the ring with Shawn. They got a close-up of the White Knight's face. There's no chance in hell that that is Kane. So I tend to believe it was, in fact, that Jeff Gaylord guy. Whoever it wasn't Kane. So if that's what you hear, it's bullshit. So those were the Knights. Now, Ray Combs. Ray Combs had been the host of the Family Feud. He had also appeared at WrestleMania 8 in 92, so this was not his first time on a WWF pay-per-view. He committed suicide, I think, not long after this, actually. And he had always been my favorite Family Feud host. Now, all these years later, I look back and I know it was Richard Dawson's show. Like, he was the original host of the Family Feud. He was a little creepy, the way that he would kiss everybody, but he did meet his wife on the show, so, you know, good for him. I still think Ray Combs is a pretty good host. He's no longer my favorite, but he had been my favorite, at least until Steve Harvey came along. But if his comedy on this show was any indication, then I must have sniffed too much glue as a child to think that he was the best Family Feud host, because he was terrible here. He was awful. He was cutting jokes. People, it was dying a death. These jokes were not registering at all with people. And not only that, what was so bad about it was, so Ray Combs is out there, he's gonna be the ring announcer. And then after that, he ends up joining Vince and Bobby Heenan on commentary. But he's out there, and before he even gets to the ring introductions, they have him cutting these jokes, he's doing this routine, it's going on and on and on. It just never ends. So it's bad enough that the comedy wasn't funny. It just wouldn't fucking end. I thought the people in Boston were going to riot. Finally, he finishes the act and he introduces everybody. But this was awful. So, the other thing I wanted to mention about this match here. So, I mentioned Vince and Bobby Heenan were on commentary. And people talk about the 1992 Royal Rumble match as being Bobby Heenan's greatest performance. The greatest performance of his broadcasting career. Which would be true. I can back that up 100%. But if that is number one, I think we may have found number two. The way that he was cracking jokes on all of the Hart brothers and on Stu and Helen, on the whole family, was just comedy gold. This match is worth it to watch and not fast forward through. It does get very slow. It is a pretty dull match. I'll talk more about that in a second, but it's absolutely worth it to put this match on. Don't fast forward it. Just leave it on. And just pay attention to Bobby Heenan on commentary. Because much like the 92 Rumble, which actually was great, you know, his commentary just enhanced it. But this was an example of a match that he just made the whole match. He makes it must-see viewing just for his commentary alone. I'm sure it didn't make the family members too happy, the things he was saying. But this was Bobby at his comedic best. My two favorite moments from the match. At one point, I think Bruce Hart is in the ring. And Bobby just goes, his name is Bruce. He's like, how unfortunate. He goes, You have 9 months, and that's the best you can come up with is Bruce. And the other line was, they showed Stu Hart. Now, Stu Hart was in the corner of his sons, and he's wearing a Boston Bruins jacket because they're in Boston. And the camera guy's right behind Stu, so you get a shot of the back of the jacket, which has a Bruin on it. And a Bruin is a bear, for those who are unfamiliar with the animal kingdom. So they show this, and Bobby Heenan just goes, "Look, he's got a picture of Helen on his back." And then he goes into, well, you know, the bear is only showing a few teeth, and so that's what threw him off and made him think it was Helen, because she doesn't have that many teeth in her mouth. So you got to just watch the match. Again, it's just Bobby Heenan at his best in this match. It's just fucking fantastic. Now, the other thing about this match that's kind of interesting, the whole purpose of this match was to set up Owen Hart for his heel turn. We all know the big sibling rivalry on camera in 94, Bret Hart and Owen Hart, and it went on for years. Well, it started here. This is where the seed was planted. This is where they kind of pulled the trigger and started that turn. The story is that Vince McMahon and Pat Patterson wanted Bruce Hart originally for that spot to be the one to feud with Bret. So he was to get the spot that eventually went to Owen. What happened is that Bret fought for Owen. Because, first of all, Owen was already on the roster. They weren't doing anything with him. He's a great wrestler. This makes for very interesting viewing if you know that part of the story when the match is over. Because when the match is over, Owen Hart, who had been eliminated, the only one on his team eliminated, which plays into his meltdown, he comes back out to the ring when the match is over. Brett's on the turnbuckle celebrating. And Owen grabs Brett, he pulls him down, and he shoves him. And, you know, Bret Hart and Keith Hart now, they're trying to calm Owen down. Keith is trying to hold Owen back from going after Bret. What's noticeable here is that Bruce Hart is absent from all of this. He's standing off to the side, hands on hips, just, you know, and every time Bret turns and looks to him, almost like, hey, could you kind of get involved here? Bruce just kind of threw his hands up in the air. Like, he didn't give a shit. Like, he didn't want to have anything to do with any of this. Then later on, when all of the Harts are leaving, Bruce was the first one to get the hell out of there. So when they have a shot of Bret Hart at the end of the aisleway, they show him and they show Keith. Bruce, nowhere to be found. He already hightailed it out of there. So it's pretty obvious when you watch that, and this is just my personal observation watching this, that Bruce was pissed that he didn't get that spot. And he didn't care much to play along here at the end of this match with what they wanted him to do. I mean, I've been on Bruce's podcast before. We've never talked about this. And I never read his book. I did read a review of Bruce's book. Haven't had a chance to actually read the book itself. But in the review of it that I read, it said that in the book he talks about this. And Bruce was mostly upset with Bret for backing Owen over him. Because that could have been a big money spot for him at that time. When he really wasn't making much money doing the substitute teacher thing. And that's one of the things that Bobby Heenan kind of made fun of all the Harts for. Keith came out, they mentioned that he's a fireman, so Bobby Heenan made fun of him for being a fireman. Bruce came out, they mentioned that he was a substitute teacher, so Bobby Heenan made fun of him for being a substitute teacher. Both of them used to wrestle, but they mentioned during the match, you know, Bruce had not wrestled a match since 1991, Keith had not wrestled a match since 1989, they were all doing other things. So Bruce was teaching at the time, and one of the reasons he was so upset was, I mean, he could have made a lot of money. You know, if the company put all their muscle behind him as a big heel, and he was going to have a feud, let's say, in 94 with Bret, you know, he stood to make a lot of money, and instead Owen was the one who got that spot. So you can understand, if that's how it all went down, why he would be pissed off at Bret. So it's very, very interesting, knowing all of this now, to go back and watch and look at him and how he kind of acted and behaved here at the end. Few other things. They showed Owen's wife, Martha, sitting in the front row with some of the other Hart family members, and she was holding her son, Oj, who was just a baby at the time. I don't know, just looking at that made me kind of sad to see that. As far as the match itself, it was very, very long, and it was, I thought, largely very, very dull. And I think it was because of two things. Keith and Bruce had never wrestled for the WWE before. They, as I mentioned, they were retired for a few years as active competitors at that point. And no disrespect at all meant to them. I mean, they were fine. When they got in the ring here, they were very capable. They were fine. They didn't embarrass themselves or anything like that. I mean, it's not shocking. You know, they're Stu Hart's sons, so obviously they know how to wrestle. But the problem is that nobody knew who they were, and nobody had a reason to care. They weren't WWF guys. I don't remember them educating people. I mean, maybe they mentioned on television. I'm sure they must have, you know, mentioned who they were, and maybe they even appeared on television for a segment, but the people didn't seem to know who they were. The people didn't seem to care. They didn't really have a reason to care about these guys. You couple that with the fact that on the other side, you know, Shawn Michaels' partners are these three guys in masks. Nobody knows who the fuck they are. We have even less of a reason to care about the Knights. Ooh, the Blue Knight, the White Knight, the Red Knight. Who gives a fuck? You know, that makes five people. Two Hart brothers and three Knights. Five of the eight people in this match that nobody cared about. Nobody had a reason to care about five of the eight people in this match. Okay, so it's no wonder the crowd didn't seem to really give a shit. And it was just a very long match, very dull in many parts. And it really, the only thing that mattered in this match was the last, like, 5 minutes. The part in the match where Owen's in the ring with Shawn Michaels. Shawn Michaels, actually, I'm sorry, I take that back. Shawn's in the ring with Bret. He gives Bret Hart a thumb to the eye. And a thumb to the eye is what got this whole thing started. With him and Owen and everything, because what happened was he thumbed Bret in the eye. Bret's blind now, he can't see. He tags Owen in, or maybe Owen tagged himself in. So now Owen is in the ring with Shawn. Bret's on the outside, he's still favoring his eye. He doesn't know where he is or what's going on. He's out on the apron. And the big spot here is Owen hits the ropes. When he hits the ropes, Bret's right there in the middle, because Bret doesn't know. He knocks Bret off the apron. Bret comes crashing into the metal barricade, which looks far more devastating than it would today, you know, crashing into the black dasher boards. He just hit the steel. You know, armpit first, fell right into the guardrail, pushed it back into the front row. It's lucky he didn't hurt anybody. So all the other brothers, they jump off the apron. They're tending to Bret. Meanwhile, this distracted Owen and allowed Shawn Michaels to roll him up from behind and pin him. And that's when Owen has his meltdown. He's kicking the bottom rope. He's throwing a temper tantrum. You know, he doesn't even seem to give a shit about his brother hurt down on the floor. He just cares that, you know, Bret was in his way. And he embarrassed him. And now he caused him to be eliminated. The only member of the Hart family to be eliminated in the entire match. So it was a Shawn Michaels thumb to the eye that set this whole thing in motion. See, so not only did Shawn play a role in the Montreal Screwjob, he single-handedly caused the rivalry between Bret and Owen. I mean, this guy's been a real thorn in Bret's side now for a number of years here. And so it did lead to the angle. Bret and Owen did temporarily make up. They were a tag team. I think, like, for the holidays, I remember them doing promos on TV. Everything's cool now. Everything's cool. We're brothers. We're partners. And they had that match with the Quebecers at the Royal Rumble for the tag team titles. And Bret hurt his knee. And Owen kicked his leg out from his leg when the match was over. And that, of course, led to the match that Bret said he would never accept. He never, ever would wrestle his brother. That's what he always said. Well, he changed his mind. And he had the match with Owen. Classic match at WrestleMania 10. They had a classic cage match at SummerSlam that year. I mean, these guys were tearing it up. And it made Owen Hart into a real superstar. Up to that point, Owen Hart was just a guy in the roster. You know, everybody knew he could wrestle. He could do a lot of high-flying stuff, even going back to his days as the Blue Blazer. He was a great guy to have on the roster, but he had no story. Now, all of a sudden, you give the guy something to sink his teeth into, and I think he knocked it out of the park. I think Owen Hart, all due respect to all the other Hart brothers and Bruce and everybody else, Owen Hart was perfect for this role. He was made for that role. The feud with Bret, the matches they had. Owen is the whiny little brat, you know, following in his brother's footsteps, winning the King of the Ring. I'm the real King of Hearts. I mean, he was great. Owen was great. If you wanted to put the title on him in 94, you could have. I don't know that he was ever going to win the championship. Like, in the later years, people wondered, well, if Owen didn't, you know, if he didn't die and he was still around, would he have been WWF champion? No, I don't think he would have been. The time to do it would have been in 94. You could have put the title on him and had him trade it back and forth with Bret. But as it is, I mean, they had a tremendous feud. And Owen's career just kind of went from there, right? You know, he He hooked up with the British Bulldog later on. They became a tag team. Then the Hart Foundation faction. I mean, all of these opportunities that came up for Owen to be, you know, a fairly big star in the company, if not a main eventer, an upper mid-carder, it would never have happened if it didn't all trace back to this angle that started at the Survivor Series in 93. And as it turned out, it was his brother Brett who went to bat for him because he was not the original choice of Vince McMahon or Pat Patterson. So when you think of the story in those terms, it's fascinating, I think, to look back on how different things might have been if they went with somebody other than Owen. So if you've never seen the match before, the match itself is really nothing all that special. It really is the historical significance of what came out of it. But also Bobby Heenan's commentary just made that frickin' match. And it also turned out to be Bobby Heenan's final pay-per-view ever for WWF. I mean, the only appearance after that he made was many years later in that gimmick battle royal at WrestleMania. Him and Gene Okerlund did commentary. But this was it. This was his last pay-per-view. And I think he was only on TV for another 2 weeks until they did the angle where Gorilla Monsoon kicked him out, literally threw him out of the building. Which is still to this day, if you watch that, one of the saddest moments I've ever seen on a WWF show, ever. It's comedic, the way they did it. It's classic Bobby Heenan. But if you look at the very end there, when he collects his belongings, and he kind of salutes, and then walks off, and you could see he's like legitimately crying. Like, he doesn't want to leave, but he is leaving. It's just one of the saddest things to me. Because, you know, Bobby Heenan in WCW, he was never the same. It was, to me, it was just not the same person. So in a lot of ways, this was the end of an era in WWE when Heenan left. You can follow me on Twitter, at Solomonster. Don't forget to vote in our Raw poll on Twitter every Monday night as soon as the show goes off the air. You can also tweet me your suggestions for said tweet, which we sometimes do here on the show. Don't forget, you can vote once every day, daily voting. On WrestlingRadioAwards.com. Only vote once a day. Don't vote more than that. Scroll down to the Show of the Year category. You can write in Solomonster Sounds Off to nominate us for Show of the Year here in the 2016 Awards. And we will be back for episode 413 next weekend. We'll have predictions for the NXT TakeOver London show, which takes place on December 16th. Don't forget, that's airing live at 3 p.m. Eastern. So if you are not a fan of spoilers, I would suggest you stay off social media that afternoon, as I plan to do. So we'll talk about that and have a whole bunch of other fun stuff to get into next weekend. Until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week. Thank you, as always, for the support, and we will see you right back here for more Sound Off next weekend. Take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster Sounds Off.
Hulk Hogan's WCW contract splattered all over the internet. He got a $2 million signing bonus, 25% of the ticket revenue from all Nitro and Thunder events that he appeared on. He also got $20,000 per month for as long as he was part of the NWO, 50% of the profits from any Hulk Hogan merchandise that was sold, and a minimum $675,000 for any pay-per-view he appeared on. You know what I say? I say good for him. If I could get that kind of deal for myself, if somebody wanted me that badly, they were that stupid, then great! Always ask for what you feel you're worth. Your boss should have the guts to say no. WCW wanted to blow this guy so badly, they put a towel down on the floor so they wouldn't get rug burned.
Solomonster Sounds Off.
Since 2007, the Solomonster Sounds Off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster Sound Off.